Welcome to Down Among the Donkeys, a podcast from the Donkey Sanctuary. In 13 episodes, we are telling the story behind the founding of one of the biggest equine charities in the world. Down Among the Donkeys by Dr. Elizabeth Svensson. Chapter 1. Why Donkeys? Why donkeys? I must be asked this by almost everyone I meet, and even now I can't really give them a straightforward answer. It seems that circumstances throughout my life must have led me to the position of being responsible for over 700 donkeys and to devoting the major part of my life to these beautiful, gentle, pathetic, mistreated creatures. My car caught fire. It was early in March 1954, a rainy, wet Saturday afternoon. My current boyfriend, Tony, had persuaded me to go to a football match at Halifax, and I went because I could try out the new car just provided for me by my father's company, for whom I was working. Out we backed onto the main road outside the house and off down the road. Only a short way on, the very strong smell of burning became overpowering. I pulled the car to the side of the road, and by the time I had switched off the engine, flames were already coming out of the bonnet and smoke filled the car. I was horror-struck, as it was my new car. I felt quite unable to do anything. Tony was overcome by smoke, retching at the side of the road. A very old Austin Ruby came chugging up the road towards me. It stopped with a squeal of brakes, and out climbed the most handsome man I had ever seen in my life. He grabbed a fire extinguisher from the back of his car, wrenched open the bonnet of my car, and within a few seconds all that was left was a horrible smell of burning and a few whiffs of smoke. "Whatever happened?" asked the strange man, looking me straight in the eye. "I just don't know," I answered. "I'd only just started when this happened. It must have been an electrical fault or something." We stood looking at each other across the smouldering bonnet, and it is no exaggeration to say that we both fell in love at that moment. "Do you want any more help?" the tall man asked. "No, thank you," I replied weakly, and he turned and got into his car and drove away up the road. I stood mesmerized and watched as he drove into the driveway of a house on the right, almost at the top of the road. Tony was somewhat irritable for the rest of the day, and we spent endless time arranging for the garage to collect the car and for the repairs to be done. I was absent-minded as far as Tony was concerned, in fact, totally immersed in thoughts about the man who had helped me. It took me 3 days of cold canvassing up and down Hullen Edge Road, with the excuse of looking for a garage for my new car, before I met the tall stranger again. But, having met, Niels and I saw each other every single day until our marriage 7 months later. The only reason we delayed so long was that Niels was already engaged to a girl in Denmark, and as his total finances were invested in the engagement ring he had sent her, we had to wait for it to come back, so that he had sufficient money to buy the wedding ring, and also I had to disentangle myself. I had always been a very skinny and attractive child, but I managed to have an extremely happy childhood. I was lucky in having an elder sister, Pat, who was an extremely good friend and kind, fun-loving parents, and we lived in a very old, large house called Ash Grove, which stood in the industrial part of the West Riding of Yorkshire between Elland and Brighouse. My father worked at the large pipeworks where we mined clay and manufactured drain pipes. This had been founded by my grandfather, who had run it with his two sons. Up the hill at Ashgrove Cottage lived my father's brother Stanley and his three boys, Malcolm, Derek and Brian. And together, the five of us really made up a gang who had the most wonderful time, particularly when we went off for day expeditions through the woods and down to the river, where we conceived tremendous projects such as building boathouses, making camps, and even a meeting room which was later, during the war, to be taken over by the fire brigade as their headquarters in our area. My grandmother suffered badly from asthma and would sometimes go and stay in St. Anne's for 6 weeks at a time, as the air there suited her. My grandfather visited her every weekend. As my other grandmother lived near Preston, we found ourselves making for Lancashire almost every third weekend. It was always a bit tedious, as we had to be on our best behaviour, and it took the whole of a precious Sunday. One day, on the route to St. Anne's, in my father's little Hillman, which I remember so well, he deviated from his normal route, and we went past a field in the Calder Valley. I saw there two donkeys, which thrilled me. And from that day, every single weekend we went to Lancashire, my father had to go an extra 8 miles so that little Betty could see her donkeys. This is the earliest time I remember seeing donkeys, and they made an immense impression on me. My father would park as near to the field as he could, and I would run across the verge and climb up the post and rail fencing and shout, "Donkeys!" They would always come right across to me. I think it was then that I really fell in love with them. They had such soft, warm muzzles, such beautiful, trusting eyes, and they seemed to look at me as if perhaps they knew what was going to happen in the future. I liked to think they did, anyway. I was always disappointed when my time was up, and I had to get back in the car and face the weekend in St. Anne's. In 1939, everything changed. I was 9. My parents were in the United States and Canada on business, and in fact, sitting on Montreal Station the day that war was declared. Pat and I were staying in New Longton with our grandmother, and we spent many anxious weeks waiting for them to get back. Prior to going to America, my mother had started taking swimming lessons with us, and could swim the breadth of the pool. My grandmother always remembered me saying, "Well, at least if they get torpedoed, they will be able to swim back now." Things were never the same after that. My sister and I had to change from Princess Mary High School at Halifax to the grammar school at Brighouse, because it was nearer for us, travel-wise. This made me particularly sad. My best friend was June Evers, with whom I had been going to school since the age of 5 in Halifax, and of course, she had to stay on there. We did, however, keep in touch and used to go out together almost every weekend. The first time the sirens went, we were all absolutely terrified. My father got out of the car and we all drove up to the works and, in the pitch dark, climbed up the ladder to the mineshaft and walked through the mines into the central mine that had been designated as an air raid shelter. People from Elland gradually came to join us, and there we all sat for 5 hours in the cold, dripping darkness, the men frequently walking the 3 miles back to the face of the mine to see what was going on. Every second my father was away, I imagined him being killed by a bomb, and I think the first raids, when nothing actually happened, were probably the worst ones. Unfortunately, our house was near the River Calder, and the Germans used to use this as a guide when going to Huddersfield, Bradford and Leeds on bombing raids. One night we did get 3 bombs within a quarter of a mile, and this was the only time the sirens hadn't gone. My mother was washing my hair at the time, and it was as if somebody had banged their fist hard on the bottom of the bath as the first one fell. By the time the third one of the stick had fallen, my mother had me out in a towel and downstairs. It is amazing how fast one can move when the necessity arises. Another vivid memory is of a Sunday afternoon when my mother had brought out a long-saved tin of pineapple, a real luxury in those days. and we were just about to have the first mouthful when we heard an aeroplane coming over the house extremely low. We all ran into the garden and saw a small plane at roof height, skimming down towards the river below the house. A few seconds later came the sound of a terrible crash. We ran down through the garden, across the daffodil fields, through the railings that separated us from the canal and the river. There, slowly sinking, was a small, single-engined plane with the pilot trapped in the cockpit. I hadn't realised how brave my father was until this moment, but without any hesitation he jumped straight into the water, swam across to the plane and, with my grandfather, who had arrived on the bank shouting instructions, managed to pull himself up on the sinking wings and push the cockpit roof back. My mother, next to me, was shouting, "Vincent, do be careful, it's going to blow up." But he took no notice and within minutes was helping the very dazed pilot out. The plane had ploughed through electric cables as it came in across the field, and my father had to help the airman back across the canal rather than risk touching the cables on the aircraft. The pilot, Wendell Nelson, was an American and became a firm friend of our family, visiting us frequently on his leaves. Sadly, he was shot down over the North Sea 2 years later. He made a great impression on our family, and we still keep in contact with his friend, Bob Wallace, whom he used to bring with him. I was never a very healthy child. I seemed to get every illness and sickness in the book, and I remember with the greatest pleasure the recuperation times I was given after severe bouts of scarlet fever, chickenpox, measles, and whooping cough. I would wander round our wonderful wild garden, spending hours watching small wildlife. My mother frequently had to put up with small boxes of injured creatures reviving in the safety of my bedroom. There was the small hedgehog, Benji, I took in. He lived in my room in a shoebox for about 5 weeks, recovering, I hoped, from being knocked unconscious on the busy road outside our house. One morning at about 5 o'clock, a strange pattering sound woke me. It sounded like rain on the windows, and in fact I looked there first before realising that the noise came from Benji's box in the corner. I opened the lid. Benji the hedgehog had died, and leaping up and down were what can only be described as thousands of insects of varying sizes banging themselves in a futile attempt to escape from the box. I was quite horrified, having no idea that Benji was host to such a large number of parasites, and for quite a while hedgehogs didn't appear in my bedroom. It wasn't easy for my parents, living next door to my grandfather and grandmother before they retired to St. Anne's permanently, particularly when Grandpa ran the works and he would come round during the evening, asking Father to go back and stoke up a kiln or deal with some difficult sales crisis. I wasn't surprised when my parents decided that we should buy a house in Elland itself, so that they could have a little more privacy, and for the first time, their own house. They fell in love with a house called Windy Ridge, situated up Hullen Edge Road in Elland, and managed to find the necessary deposit. We all moved in 1943. I missed the old garden terribly and found the journey to school extremely difficult, as I had to walk down the steps, as they were known, which consisted of over 200 steep steps onto a lower road, catch a trolley bus into Elland, and then a petrol bus to Brighouse. The return journey was even worse, and having come out of school at 4 o'clock, I didn't get home until 5:20. One particular Friday evening, I felt ill and remember crawling up the steps at Hullen Edge and struggling to get back to the house, feeling absolutely terrible. My father was fitting curtains that night, and I lay in bed wondering when the banging was ever going to stop. The next morning, the doctor was called and acute appendicitis diagnosed. The appendix had ruptured by the time they operated, but they seemed to think it had been drained sufficiently. After 2 weeks in hospital, I was sent home, apparently cured. I didn't feel it. In fact, I felt awful for the next 3 or 4 weeks. To cheer me up, Dad suggested a family outing to see the music hall star, Norman Evans, at Halifax Palace. And one Thursday evening, we all went by bus to see the performance. Halfway through, whilst Norman Evans was doing his Over the Garden Wall act, I remember feeling a very sharp pain shooting through my right hand, and looking down in the dim lights of the theatre, I could see it looked slightly different from the other. The doctor came the next day, and he thought it was a little arthritis, perhaps. Over the next few days, though, not only my hand, but my whole arm started swelling, and despite sulfonamide treatment and every drug known at that time, nothing seemed to slow the infection's pace. When the pain was halfway down my back and I was almost totally delirious, I was once again admitted to the Duke of York's hospital. I can remember lying in bed, and although I was reputedly unconscious, I could hear every word that was being said, and heard the specialist telling my parents that there was no hope at all. I had something called septicemia, which had turned into osteomyelitis, a disease which ended in death. Although I heard this and saw my parents' tear-stained faces, I really wasn't very concerned. In fact, I was floating happily above them, held on what appeared to be a very thin thread, and beyond the long corridor that I felt to be in, I could see the faces of people who I had loved and who had died and who were all waiting for me. It was the most magnificent feeling of freedom and exhilaration, one quite inexplicable, which has made me confident that there is a life after death and has left me with no fear at all of dying. I saw myself being wheeled away. I saw myself in the operating theatre, and I never felt so disappointed in my life as when I was dragged back to my body on the table. Having been given no hope, my parents signed an operating form and agreed to the use of the trial of penicillin, which so far, to the best of my knowledge, had only been used on the British Army in Bradford. There is no doubt it saved my life. The next 3 years were very hard indeed for me. I had so many operations we all lost count. Every time the hand and arm seemed to be settling down, another piece of bone would break away and have to be removed. And although I managed to return to school after the first year, I wasn't allowed out in the playground at lunchtime and had to go for dressings twice a day to the doctor's surgery and for massage 3 afternoons a week. So I was different from all the other girls. One day the headmistress called my parents to school and said, "I'm very sorry, Mr. Knowles, but Betty won't be able to sit her school certificate, as there seems very little chance that she'll pass." Now, by this time, Pat had obtained a place at the Rachel Macmillan Training College, where she was going to become a teacher, and I desperately wanted to follow in her footsteps. The headmistress, Miss Ford, was persuaded to let me take the exams, even though not being able to use my right hand made things extremely difficult. I did manage to get my school certificate with 7 passes and credits, the most surprising being a credit in art, where they seemed to appreciate the peculiar style I had developed with my left hand. I developed a tremendous faith in life and its purpose, and I felt that for some reason I had been spared death, and felt determined to find that reason. My parents had always taken us to church regularly, and I was confirmed by Thomas Cashmore, then the vicar of Brighouse, and one of the greatest friends and advisers I have had in my life. Confirmation meant a great deal to me, and the ideals I learned then, and through my association with Thomas Cashmore, now retired Bishop of Dunwich, have stood me in good stead for the rest of my life. My poor parents really had some problems with me. In the sixth form, I was sitting quietly studying one day when my friend casually threw a pair of scissors to the girl sitting next to me, working on embroidery. The first thing I was aware of was something striking my eye, and within 20 minutes we were once again on our way to Bradford, but this time to the eye infirmary. For 3 weeks, both eyes were bandaged and serious permanent injury averted. Once again, I was given time to sit and think and work things out. At the age of 17, it made a deep and lasting impression upon me. I found I seemed to know when people were coming and to be able to feel their thoughts very much more than when I was busy on my normal teenage occupations, which had always seemed so important. College was a very happy time for me. The buildings were situated in the heart of the slums of London in Deptford. The college provided a very real chance to work with deprived children and to learn a great deal of psychology, philosophy and teaching. It was nice to come out with a first-class Froebel certificate to start me on my teaching career. I decided to live at home, as Pat had by this time married and moved away. I settled in at Windy Ridge and got a job at the local school at West Vale. Bearing in mind that I had just finished 3 years' training, the main emphasis of which was using the full facilities of the school, in particular for creative play, I took my nursery class into the little garden every day and set up easels, water play, sand and so on, which the children used to the fullest possible creative advantage. The visiting inspector to the school was absolutely appalled, and I was summoned to the headmaster's office and told by the inspector that unless I brought the children indoors and taught them properly sitting at tables, I would get a letter from the local authority. In the end, I decided to carry on teaching as I had been trained. Once again, by pure coincidence, the same inspector arrived and I received a very severe dressing down. My father's company was progressing well, and the secretary, Fanny Sutcliffe, who had been there since my grandfather founded it 32 years before, was the mainstay of the office. Then, suddenly, Fanny suffered a stroke, and it seemed she would not be able to work for some months, if ever. Realizing I was unhappy, my father asked me to give up teaching and help run the works. It seemed the right psychological moment to make a change. I learned touch typing, shorthand and bookkeeping at night school and served my notice as a teacher. It was certainly different working in an office tackling large wage sheets for over 100 men, 28 of whom were minors and had different shift rates and bonuses, and the rest of whom were piece workers and every single person paid at a different rate. I got through and the men got wages. Those that didn't get enough complained, and those that got too much never said anything, so eventually it all worked out. The selling side of the business on which my father concentrated interested me, and I began doing the selling for him over the telephone. I had learned to drive at college, but until one particular Saturday morning, I hadn't driven anything larger than my father's car. On this Saturday, I was alone in the office when a very irate customer from an airfield near Hull rang complaining that the load of pipes promised the day before hadn't been delivered. His men were working overtime at the weekend, and what were we going to do about it? I found our driver had been taken ill, and it had been assumed that the load could go on the Monday. Our very good customer didn't agree, so I said, "Well, never mind, we'll get it there somehow." My father and his brother Stanley were away, so I decided to take this 6-ton load myself. In those days, gears weren't quite so easy as today, and double declutching was essential. It took 3 telephone books propped in the back of the seat before I could even push in the clutch pedal completely, and when I left the yard with all the pipes juddering round my ears in the cab behind me, I did hope I was doing the right thing. It seemed hundreds of miles, but in fact was just about 60 to Hull. Every traffic light was a challenge and every hill a nightmare. There was a whole row of men who were busy digging a trench where the pipes were to be laid, and as I drew up, not a head moved. Suddenly, as I opened the door and began the jump down, one of the men saw me, and a stunned silence fell upon the line of men as I climbed down from the wagon and said, "Well, who's going to help me unload, then?" After that, I always got a lot more respect from the men in our yard when I walked in. I seem to have a whole horde of boyfriends, none particularly serious. I like men to be companions, and that was the main ingredient for a good boyfriend. My parents got a little confused with so many boys phoning and calling at the house, and my father put a list by the telephone, and I had to put what division I classed them in, i.e. first, second or third division. If a third divisioner rang up, my father would say happily, "Oh no, I am sorry, she's busy tonight." And only first divisioners got priority. He could not understand that Niels Svensson walked away with the cup without even appearing in the divisions. Niels, despite his name, is British, and his family had come to England years before. His mother had married twice, and he had six brothers and half-brothers. He was born in 1929 and brought up mainly in a large house on the outskirts of Exeter by his stepfather, Sven Iversen. He was always very mechanically minded and at the age of 17 purchased a very old motorbike, which he took apart, reconstructed and sold at a good profit. His business acumen developed early. Niels did his national service in the RAF, working on radar and eventually going to Malta. He had an accident there which affected his left eye permanently, and he was invalided out of the RAF and went back to Exeter. Niels had already been accepted to read chemistry at Exeter University and added botany, having done some work in that field between leaving the RAF and going up. His grant was only £2 a week, and things were very tough for a while, but he supplemented the grant with extra money made from photography. At the end of the third year, having obtained his BSc, he won a scholarship to Cambridge to study tropical agriculture, which would lead to a job in Trinidad. During the summer holidays, however, one of his elder brothers, Jorgen, offered him a job in the new business he had started at Elland in Yorkshire. Niels became so involved in the manufacture of Metalife, a liquid zinc-rich paint that stopped rust, that he was persuaded by his brother to stay on after the time he should have gone to Trinidad, and he managed to obtain a year's extension on that grant. Niels lived with Jorgen and his wife on Hullen Edge Road, in fact about eight houses above Windy Ridge, and it was whilst driving back from work on Saturday that he came across the car in the road that had contained me. Niels could do everything better than I could. It really was the first time that I ever seemed to have met somebody who I could respect in every way. When Niels had an argument with his brother and moved to a flat in a very old house on the outskirts of Halifax, we would sit evening after evening listening to classical records, reading philosophers like Uspensky, talking and exploring each other's minds into the long hours of the night. In these permissive days, I suppose some people may find it hard to believe that at this stage sex never came into our meetings, apart from the inevitable kiss and cuddle, but this was something that we were saving till we were married. It gave us time to really get to know each other and to become the tremendous companions which we still are today. We played tennis in the snow at the end of March, we played golf, we swam, we fished, and we worked together. Many a weekend we spent painting chimneys with Metalife in that area, and many a large vault in Yorkshire wool mills has been personally painted by Niels and me. One game of golf was to have far-reaching consequences. There was a terrible hole at Bradley Hall Golf Club where we played, the 13th. You had to drive over a deep ravine to reach the green, and Niels' ball always landed in the stream which ran down it. The first time he ever did a perfect drive and got across, he turned to me, flushed with elation, and said, "Darling, will you marry me?" And I said, "Yes." My parents loved Niels from the minute they met him, and he fitted into our family in a most amazing way. The only thing my father never got used to was his surname. He would have preferred a good old Yorkshire name in the family. We converted a flat at Ash Grove, and after our marriage on the 20th of October 1954, moved into a flat in the house in which I was born. I thought I had known a great deal about Niels before we got married, but I had no idea of his inventive genius until I found that the new cooker, a wedding present from my parents, could be used to wake us up in bed. Niels, having sent me out on a long shopping expedition, completely rewired it to the bedroom radio, and the automatic setting on the electric oven blasted us out of bed at 7 o'clock on a regular basis. It was a bit difficult to accept that when I switched on the grill, I was more likely to get music whilst I worked than toast. We were pretty hard up and had very little money with which to furnish our rented flat, which ran the full length of the old converted stable. Our bedroom was at one end, and Niels had the rather strange habit of coming to bed at night by setting off from the kitchen at 90 miles an hour, running down the corridor, and then leaping onto the bed. One thing we had invested in was a good double bed. By June, to our horror, we found the bed collapsing on us, and I rang the manufacturers, who had specifically quoted how strong and durable it was. Their representative came round to have a look, and he and I removed the mattress and stood gazing at the metal base. The whole frame was bent in the middle, and this, of course, made the mattress sag. He looked at me with a horrified expression on his face and said, "What on earth's been happening to the bed?" As his eyes gazed at mine, he suddenly became aware that I was 6 months pregnant, and a slow blush began to appear over his face. I do beg your pardon," he stammered. "Of course, we will refund the money for the bed." And the next day we received a cheque for the full amount in the post. Lisa was born safely, albeit 3 weeks late, on the 13th of October. The doctor had booked me into the nursing home 3 days previously, and I had suffered all sorts of indignities as they tried to get my daughter to make her appearance in the world. Having failed my third medical induction the night before she was born, I was absolutely fed up when Niels came to visit me. Niels has never been good at hospital visiting, and he sat by my bed very miserably.
"I really wanted to go and see the Dambusters in Huddersfield."
"So do I," said I, sitting bolt upright in bed. "Let's go." I got dressed quickly and quietly and left a note on the pillow saying, "Gone to the pictures, back later." We crept away into the night. There was a long queue when we got to the cinema, but the manager took pity on us and my obvious state, and the usherette, when moving us along the row, flashed her torch into people's faces and said, "Stand well back, please, ladies and gentlemen." And so I managed to totter to a seat. The labour pains started halfway through the film, but we were determined to see the end. A very angry nursing staff, who weren't used to their patients opting out on them, met us when we got back, but they were pleased that the sortie seemed to have set things going. By lunchtime the next day, Lisa had arrived. 7 days later was our first wedding anniversary. I asked my mother if she would bring my wedding dress into the hospital, so I could meet Niels with it on, holding the baby. My idea of a joke. Of course, when it arrived, I couldn't fit into it, as my 22-inch waist had changed somewhat drastically. My mother provided me with a white nightdress, and it never ceases to surprise me that Neil's first comment was, "Darling, how did you manage to get into your wedding dress?" A Marks and Spencer's nightie would have done just as well as a wedding dress so far as Niels was concerned. Lisa was a great joy, but it was a difficult period for us as Niels and his brother unfortunately fell out over the share structure of their new company, and this meant Niels looking for a new job. So, with our small baby Lisa, we left home and the north and moved to Bridgewater in Somerset, where he became a manager at British Cellophane. For me, the move meant losing my job at the works. Even though I had Lisa and another baby on the way, I did feel that there had to be more to life than a constant round of nappies. Niels and I were both 26, full of energy and enthusiasm, and we gradually realised there was no quick way to the top through Niels' present job. We talked and talked and talked, and finally decided to form our own company. To do what?
we still had to decide. The seemingly endless rows of wet nappies provided the answer. A simple, efficient dryer was what was urgently needed, and we decided this was the product we would design, manufacture, and sell. We found a lazy tong rack in Woolworths, and Niels wound an electric element into a biscuit tin. We filled the rack with wet nappies and placed it over the biscuit tin. Niels plugged in his new invention and we stood back to see how quickly the nappies would dry. "It's working," I said happily as clouds of steam began to appear from the nappies. And then we smelt it. It was not steam emerging but smoke from our scorching carpet. We realised that to achieve convection currents the heater would have to be lifted off the floor. The next attempt with legs worked, but the strange black square on the carpet remained with us for life. Once Niels had perfected the dryer, we chose the name Modern Equipment Company and set up our small partnership. The total capital we could scrape together was £120, and with this and unlimited enthusiasm, we started. Niels was being paid £800 a year, and apart from buying the normal essentials of life, I had to budget for thermostats, elements, wooden racks, and sales leaflets. We had to order 200 cases before the Bridgewater firm would accept an order from us, and we had to store these in our bathroom, as it was the only space we had. Niels rushed home every evening from work, straight into the little potting shed we rented, and assembled dryers from the parts we had purchased. I would set off in our small van with Lisa and my bump to do my best to sell them. Trying to get a firm in Bristol to buy some dryers and not feeling particularly well, I sat down in the shop and the buyer asked me rather anxiously when the baby was due. I explained it was already 3 weeks late. In a panic, he immediately signed the order with no further dispute. I left happily, selling. While extremely pregnant, was very beneficial to our company. We took on a nurse this time, as I had hated hospitals, and she moved in the day Paul was due. It was quite a squeeze on our resources, having to pay the nurse and feed her whilst waiting for Paul to make his appearance. The nurse was a very keen knitter and had set up her machine in our lounge. It had driven us mad for the last 3 weeks, and when I got my first pains, I quietly retreated into our bedroom next door, as much to get away from the noise of the knitting machine as to have the baby. The 1957 Oxford and Cambridge boat race was on, and Niels was happily watching it with roars of in, out, coming from the box. The whole thing happened so quickly that nobody heard my first two or three shouts. By the time Niels and the nurse arrived, Paul was already halfway into the world. He was a super baby with a very placid character, and he and Lisa, who adored him from the moment he arrived, were wonderful children. By January 1958, we had got the dryers into places like Harrods and Heales of London, but desperately needed more capital. Some good friends in Bridgewater bravely volunteered, and our little company then became a limited concern. One of the new shareholders drew our attention to an advertisement in the News Chronicle, offering a prize for the person most able to get ahead in a business if they were given a prize of £5,000. This was to be televised over a 12-week period, and we decided to apply. We wrote a long letter putting forward our reasons why we thought we were most able to get ahead, and to our joy, the application was selected for the final. It was exciting, just being invited up to London by the News Chronicle. We stayed at the Clarendon Court Hotel up Edgware Road, and the television programmes came from the Maida Vale studio only 2 miles away. The judges were Lady Lewisham, Lord Halsbury, Sir Frederick Hooper and George Woodcock. On the day of the actual programme, we were incredibly nervous. Each contestant had somebody to look after him, and we thought how kind of the BBC. Until Niels realised that the Mr. Pickwick assigned to him wasn't doing it for Niels' sake, but to make quite sure he didn't slip off and miss the programme. It was an absolutely nail-biting experience, but to our amazement and delight, Niels came up with the right answers and won the treasured prize of £5,000. Niels went back to work when we got home next morning, but after 2 hours I had to telephone him to come back home quickly and help. A constant stream of visitors arrived, wanting to buy the dryers. People telephoned to offer advice or for jobs, and journalists to interviewers. Niels had to pack in his job with British Cellophane and come in full-time as managing director of the Modern Equipment Company Limited. We had planned a very elaborate campaign to get ahead with the £5,000, because although the sum was large enough to solve our immediate financial problems, it had to be doled out very carefully if we were to expand the business as fully as we wanted. We invested in a typist, which relieved a lot of my time from some of the more mundane tasks of writing letters and making out invoices. The progress of our company was quite meteoric. I was in charge of the sales side and Niels of the manufacturing side, and by 1960 we eventually had to build our own factory in Yeovil. Building up the business so rapidly involved an enormous amount of work, and both Niels and I learned all the way. A year later we had 3 sorts of dryers on the market and a turnover approaching £500,000. Up to now, we had always rented flats and houses, as all our money was invested firmly in the business. The children were very happy and growing up fast. Niels and I were delighted to find that another baby was on the way in 1961, as we had always wanted at least 4 children. At this time in West Chinook, the village where we lived near Yeovil, a building plot became available, which we bought, and with the help of an extremely good local builder, we built Deepwell House. It was a beautiful dream house, built of local stone and had 2.5 acres of ground. Once settled in, we bought Donko, our first donkey, who became one of the family from the second he arrived. The children really loved him, and we all spent happy hours going on expeditions, playing cowboys and Indians with Donko helping both sides, and otherwise living a contented family life. As children, we had our holidays on the Norfolk Broads, and I had always loved sailing. Niels was very enthusiastic to try, and living near the sea, we decided to buy a small sailing dinghy and try our hand at dinghy racing. We joined Lyme Regis Club. Niels, of course, was skipper, and I was the crew. And on a 505, one of the skills was that the crew trapezes. You wear a special harness with the edge of your toes on the gunwale's clip on the wire which is attached to the mast, and as the boat heels over, you project yourself out over the sea as far as possible. We certainly had some hilarious times. Niels was learning the art of helmsmanship, and quite frequently he decided to come about whilst I was still out on the wire. This led to frequent duckings and capsizes, and eventually led, I think, to our only real row. Having capsized 3 times in one particular race, Niels pulled me aboard spluttering and indicated that I was not fit to crew his boat. That did it. I did not say a word. I merely went back into the water and swam the 1.5 miles back to the clubhouse, leaving Niels on his own to try and finish the race. By the time a quiet Niels arrived back at the clubhouse, I had been through the Yachts and Yachting magazine, found a 505 for sale called Cresta, telephoned the owner and arranged to see the boat the next day. Needless to say, I went ahead and bought my own boat, and with a super young crew, we competed against Niels even to the stage of the national championships in Torquay, where I was the only woman helm. We did have great fun, and I think it fair to say that the honours were fairly equal, and we were delighted to be awarded the Lyme Regis Sailing Club Sportsman of the Year trophy, mainly, I think, because we swam past the finishing post so many times. My third pregnancy was highly enjoyable, as the business was going very well. As usual, the baby was 3 weeks late and was born at home, so that the waiting time didn't interfere with home or business life. In the event, the birth turned out to be quite terrifying. Clive was born safely at just over 9 months, and everything seemed to be going extremely well, when I began to hemorrhage severely. For a short time, it seemed that Clive might be motherless, but a hastily summoned ambulance from Crewkerne, with sirens blazing through the village, arrived in the nick of time, and the essential blood transfusion saved the day. Now, with three fine, healthy children, we talked seriously about a fourth. There were many children in need of good homes, and the adoption societies were always looking for suitable parents to take these children in. We resolved there and then that in view of the plight of so many babies, we would adopt our next child. We were expanding our business faster and faster, and Niels was interested in going into the dishwasher market, which we felt was going to be the up-and-coming domestic appliance of the future. Thorn Electrical Industries saw us at the Ideal Home exhibition in 1961, demonstrating our dishwasher, and eventually made such a tempting offer that we were persuaded to sell out, and we joined Tricity of Thorn Electric. Both of us had mixed feelings over the sale of Modec. We had had such great fun building it up together that we had the usual worries about how to work as small cogs in such a very large organisation. Our fears were well founded. The promises made by Thorn in good faith had to be broken as problems struck the domestic appliance market, and the manufacture of our dryer was moved to their factory in the north. With the greatest difficulty, we found jobs for all our workers, sold our beautiful house, and moved up to their London offices. We settled on Bourne End in a nice house near the river, where the children seemed to thoroughly enjoy themselves falling in and out of canoes on the little Abbot's Brook that flows into the Thames. They were all developing strong personalities by this time, and we all made the most of our stay near London, with its theatres and galleries and museums. Niels and I joined the Upper Thames Yacht Club and, our earlier differences settled, competed in the International 14 class. We really had some fun. On one occasion, I remember us sailing triumphantly past the clubhouse, having won a race in a particularly tricky wind. Our spinnaker was up, and in full view of the race committee and spectators, we broke our concentration with a great hug and kiss, and then, before we knew it, we were both catapulting through the air. The spinnaker sheet had caught on one of the mooring posts, a few feet off the bank. What a capsize to remember, but it was well worthwhile, and we both crawled out, muddy and laughing, to face the task of sorting our upturned boat out. Sailing the Upper Thames reaches has always been tricky. In places, the houses cut off all the wind, and on one hot, airless day, one old lady opened her window as we drifted by, and Niels is sure the draught she made enabled us to pass two boats. Sadly, the liaison with Thorn didn't work out as we had all hoped. We did find it very difficult to be employees, and eventually packed it in, sold up again, and took our little family down to Cornwall to start the demanding job of putting a boatyard back on its feet. Whilst we did enjoy Cornwall, particularly the sailing and the fact that we had much more time to be with our children, the climate was horrible. The winter mists came in during early November, and until March, we seemed to sit in a damp, humid atmosphere, feeling pathetic and sorry for ourselves. We sat for hours thinking what sort of new business we could form. We loved working together and wanted the fun and challenge of starting a new company. Our thoughts turned to hotel life. This seemed an ideal way of being able to live comfortably with one's capital in a safe place, and to be able to have sufficient staff around to make a social life somewhat easier with a perpetual supply of babysitters. Parting with Donko had been a real sorrow when we moved from Deepwell, and the children were constantly asking for another donkey. It was in the back of my mind that we might find somewhere with enough ground to start a small donkey stud, and I was very keen to try my hand at breeding donkeys. After a search lasting about 6 months, we found the Salston Hotel at Ottery St. Mary in Devonshire. This was an extremely large, old country house with 8 acres of ground, almost completely run down, and seemingly ideal for our purposes. We were hooked immediately, and the challenge of building it up began.